Chapter 36. 4 days later. Hounslow, Iwell Province. After leaving Hetman Stent, the guide led them past Iwell's patrols and left them a mile and a half inside Iwell.
"This is as far as I go. Even though the Iwellese don't run patrols any farther from the border, watch out for the Narthani. For the next 20 miles, there aren't many patrols until you get closer to Hounslow, and they don't keep to a schedule. Avoid villages and farms. My advice is keep to the forest patches as much as possible. They curve southwest and back toward Hounslow. It'll take you some miles out of a direct line to the city, but with less chance of being seen."
Following the guide's advice, after 4 hours of creep and hide, they had progressed only 3 miles closer to Hounslow.
"Fuck this," said Kales, after they hid from a farm wagon carrying hay. "There's only a couple of hours of light left. If we're not within sight of the city by midnight, there's no way we can get about doing this tonight. We'll have to chance it. Act like we have every reason to be on these roads."
The moon Edon and the stars gave enough illumination to reveal the outline of Hounslow a mile from the forest where Balwis Kales and their three companions stood. From there, the trees and the brush gave way to grass across open terrain before reaching the river. Its far bank had a scree-covered slope, 150 yards up to Hounslow's main wall. Balwis had been here before. On his first trip to Hounslow, he and his father had camped not more than a half mile away. They had let their horses graze in the grassy field before delivering them to their new owner in the city. Balwis remembered his 14-year-old self swimming naked in the river, only to scurry for his clothes when women on the wall high above shamed him with their jeers. He smiled briefly at the memory, and how his father had laughed at his red-faced son. The pleasant memory faded as he returned to the task at hand. Standing next to Kales as they perused the Hounslow walls, Balwis marveled at the man's toughness. He had survived the 180-mile ride in as good a shape as any of the others, even with the wound that must have pained him the whole way.
I've ridden farther with worse,
was all Kales would say when Balwis had checked on him 50 miles from Kernford. Balwis had been dubious when Kales told him he would be coming along to Hounslow.
"Kales," Balwis said, "you lost 2 fingers not 16 hours ago and got a shotgun pellet alongside your skull. Both have got to hurt like hell. And how are you going to ride a horse as hard as we'll have to ride? Then what? You're a one-handed man and would be a handicap."
Kales's curses would have melted bronze. After a minute and Balwis's admiration for the man's repertoire, Kales subsided enough to form complete sentences.
"I've been hurt worse than this, and I'm not one-handed, only missing part of one. Even one-handed, I'd be able to handle any Iwellese we're likely to run into. This won't be a battle. This will be skulking around and silencing any unlucky individuals who come across us."
Balwis didn't ask for further details of why Kales obviously considered himself expert in silencing, though Balwis had his own suspicions about how Kales had spent the 23 years he'd lived off Cadellium.
"Yes, God curse it, the blasted hand hurts, but it's hurt, not missing. You get everything else ready, and I'll meet you in the Kernford Central Square in 3 hours, ready to go."
"I'm not convinced," said Balwis, "and we won't slow down for you. If you can keep up all the way to Hounslow, then we'll see."
Balwis hesitated while he considered 2 thoughts. One was that he wouldn't bet against Kales being true to his boasts. He didn't have personal experience witnessing Kales in action, but the man had taken down 3 Narthani in the dark before being struck unconscious. If he could make it to Hounslow in good condition, he might be an asset.
The second thought was that he saw no reason to bother Yosef about Kales' participation. Yosef would insist Kales couldn't go.
All right, said Balwas. See you there, but make it 2 hours. It won't take the rest of us any longer to get ready. We'll bring extra horses, including ones for you.
2 hours later, Kales waited next to a three-story building flanking the square. Balwas reined in and dismounted. The other three men he'd picked stayed on their horses. They had volunteered when told the target. All three were ex-Narthani slaves, one from Predi and two from off-island, and all were members of the Dragoon platoon of Narthani escapees. Kales didn't say anything, just held up the arm with his injured hand. The bulky bandage had been replaced by a tight wrap covering the wound and fastened to the wrist. Around the forearm were several leather straps whose purpose puzzled Balwas. Kales reached to his side and from a scabbard pulled out what appeared to be a spearhead. Most Cadellium spearheads had a hollow base that the shaft fit into, and rivets through the spearhead base and the shaft further held the two together. The spearhead Kales held out had a base of flat metal an inch wide. Balwas had seen a few like this, where the base slid into a slotted shaft and glue or twine held the two together. Kales slid the base between straps on his forearm, pulled a loose strap end and gripped the upper portion of the base with his thumb and two remaining fingers. He waved it several times, then pantomimed stabbing and slashing motions. Balwas imagined the result. The blade was 3 inches wide and thick, with a rounded upper edge tapering to a point. Balwas could picture it serving as a short sword and didn't doubt the damage it could do.
All right, said Balwas. I can see you handling yourself in a blade fight, which is more what we're likely to face than firearms.
What if there's climbing? Kales yanked on another strap end to pull the spearhead out and resheathed it. He reached into the pack at his feet for a metal hand-sized claw with a metal rod attached. He shoved the rod into the same position as the spearhead base, pulled a strap, and tugged on the claw to be sure it was firmly in place. Then Kales reached back into the sack for two larger claws he stepped into and fastened. Finally, a second, smaller claw went on the free hand, the strap tightened by his teeth. Kales turned to the stone building and started to climb, as if walking on all fours across a horizontal surface. At the top of the second story, he stopped and looked down.
Satisfied? Or should I go all the way up?
No, that's fine, said Balwas. I knew there was a reason I wanted you along. The four men laughed, and even Kales grinned.
They had watched the city for the last hour.
What do you think? Balwas asked Kales.
Wait another hour?
Too soon, answered Kales. We'll wait till most lights are out. Otherwise, there'll be too many people on the streets.
That'll only give us 3 or 4 hours to find the villa and get back out before the sun's up, said Balwas.
Can't be helped, said Kales. We'll have to be quick.
Balwas turned back to look at the city and the many lights still shining from tower windows. For a moment he felt eyes looking straight at them, and the thought rose that they still had time to abort. He quickly quashed the thought as he recalled the night of the attack. He remembered the man coming at him while he was occupied with another attacker and Sinewin hitting the man with a small chair. The man had staggered, then slashed at Sinewin. Moments later, it seemed like many minutes, Balwas remembered going over to Sinewin, lying shocked on the floor. The flap of her cheek hung below her jaw, her teeth and tongue visible. He had held the flap back in place until someone came to relieve him, so he could go with Yosef to see Mera off to Kernford and then search the back property for Kales. He also remembered Norlin and Arnid, neither of whom he knew well, both young and full of life, both now dead. He remembered Yosef's icy demeanor,
so different from how he usually behaved. For the first time, Balwis felt a personal kinship with Yosef. Although he had respected Yosef and knew he had been pivotal in how they resisted the Nathani, Balwis hadn't felt they shared emotions. Until now.
Akuyan Villa, Predi City. Okun Akuyan sat up in bed. Rabia stirred beside him, but she was harder to rouse. He crossed to the bedroom door and cracked it open. Lieutenant Nestor, one of his aides, stood rocking side to side, a tense expression on his 21-year-old face.
Sorry, General. Colonel Ketton sent a messenger. The Colonel needs you at headquarters.
Any word why?
No, General.
Send the messenger back and tell Colonel Ketton I'll be there as soon as I can. Okuyan closed the door. Now what? He wondered. Some word from Zalfa? Has he gotten into some trouble? A ship from Narthon? No, not arriving in the middle of the night. It would be dawn before a ship could moor.
What is it?
Rabia called out drowsily from the bed. No idea, said Akuyan. Ketton wants me at headquarters.
Rabia sat up in bed, the covers falling to her waist. She slept in sheer nightgowns, an emergency or not. He took a moment to gaze on her form, which never ceased to please him.
Should I get you something to eat or drink while you dress?
No, dear. Go back to sleep. If it's something I can handle, I'll try to come back to eat and get a little more sleep.
Nestor was a good aide. By the time Akuyan had splashed some water in his face, dressed, and rushed out the villa's front door, a saddled horse and four mounted guards waited for him. Another 5 minutes, and he arrived at headquarters and saluted the guards at the door as he rushed through. He took the stairs two at a time. The closer he'd gotten to headquarters, the more anxious he'd become. There had been too many surprises the last 6 months. He found Ketton and several other officers in the planning room, where maps covered the walls along with the desks and the tables that occupied most of the floor space. One man wore spurs, his uniform coated with dust. All of them stood around a map of Predi Province and talked until Ketton spotted Akuyan.
General, a messenger from Ponth. It's not confirmed yet, but several Iwilis rode into Ponth, claiming at least 100 clan horsemen are headed that way. And they include Kanon.
Akuyan remained calm. Although this was unexpected, he'd had enough experiences of being surprised that his instinctive reaction was to gather more information before making a decision.
Not confirmed, you say? Has the commander at Ponth sent out patrols to try to find these clansmen?
Sir, spoke up the messenger. 4 cavalry squads were sent out, fanning from the shore to 20 miles north and east of Ponth. They were leaving as I was, so there may be more information by now.
Maybe, said Akuyan. If there is, it's in Ponth or on the way here, but not here now.
He turned to Ketton. Colonel, let's not take any chances. He went to a wall map of an area showing 20 miles from Predi City.
Let's push the Ready Infantry Battalion out to the bridge and ford here.
Akuyan pointed at the map.
They're supposed to be able to leave on 30 minutes' notice. Another hour and a half by wagon, and they should be setting up defensive positions in 2 hours.
One of Akuyan's innovations, and one he hadn't yet convinced superiors of before he'd left for Gedalium, was using wagons to transport infantry and the men fighting on foot only when at a battle site. More traditional officers had not seen a reason to use horses to move infantry, except in unusual circumstances.
Got a semaphore message off to Erdlin and Hanslow at daybreak. Let's see if there's been any action he knows of. For here, let's make 2 plans.
1, to send a cavalry battalion and 8-pounder batteries toward Ponth, and a 2nd plan for 2 infantry regiments to begin moving after the cavalry. We won't move until we have more information. Sadaki Zer had come into the room shortly after Akuyan.
He stood looking hard at the war maps.
Assessor Hizer, what's your opinion of what we're hearing? Asked Akuyan.
As you say, General, we need more information. However, I doubt this is a serious attack on us here in Dredi Province. Even though we have fewer agents than before, there's enough to have picked up on something as big as a serious attack. I suspect this is more a spoiling raid, a big enough force to do damage. But assuming this one report is accurate, and not the imagination of some overexcited Iwilese.
Hounslow, Iwil Province. The five men stood at the base of the Hounslow main wall. Below them, down the steep, scree-covered slope, flowed the Falworth River, thankfully running relatively low, since no rain had fallen the last 6 days. As they made their way from the thicket where they'd left the horses staked out, rain began to fall. Balwas gave a quick and uncharacteristic prayer that the drizzle would continue or intensify to help hide their escape, assuming any of them survived to flee.
I wish that Moorland woman had noticed better where the gap in the wall was, whispered Kales.
That Moorland woman is Unarind, rejoined Balwas.
He had not interacted much with Mera's friend, though he'd been impressed by her steely recounting of what had happened to her and her serious attempt to remember everything she could. She reported on the gap in Hounslow's riverside wall and the route to Erdlin's villa, and went into great detail about the villa itself. Only with the latter did Anarin's composure falter, especially when describing Erdlin's bedroom, including the location of the bed when he usually went to sleep, whether he kept weapons within reach, and whether he kept a woman in the bed after he had finished with her or he sent her to sleep elsewhere.
She and Gwynedd did well to remember as much as they did, said Balwas, considering what must have gone through their minds when they risked an escape attempt and shepherded a flock of women they hadn't planned on.
Kales grunted, which Balwas took as a grudging acknowledgement.
It still leaves us needing to find the fucking hole, if it still exists and the damn Iwilese didn't seal it.
The suction can't be more than 400 yards long, said Balwas, recalling how the wall looked from the thicket.
At the moment, they could only see 30 yards.
A cloud cover and drizzle had moved in and blocked the light from the stars in Eden.
I'll go to the right and you to the left, he told Kales. Come back if you find the gap or reach the end of the bluff.
You three stay here.
Balwas ordered the other men. 6 minutes later, both Balwas and Kales returned.
I didn't find it, said Kales.
I did,
said Balwas. In a tone Kales wondered whether showed pleasure or regret.
It's about 100 yards away. It's a tight fit with the packs. But I slipped all the way in, until I found the jumble of blocks on the other side, just as Anarind and Gwynedd described.
The drizzle had changed to a steady rain, and when they exited through the gap, they froze for a moment to hear voices 30 feet above them on the wall's rampart.
God damn it! Why do I always end up with night watch when it rains?
Complained an Arthani voice, making no effort to maintain silence.
I can only think of 2 reasons,
came a loud reply from a second voice.
Either you pissed off whoever makes up the watch list, or the god North hates you.
Descriptions of what the second man could do with his private member were followed by raucous laughter, which faded as the men moved away along the wall's top. Maw was translated, and Kills commented.
If Gold really does hate that idiot up there, maybe he loves us. I think the rain is getting heavier.
Kales had no sooner whispered the words than they could hear the sound of rain pounding on rooftops and getting closer by the second. They had crawled through the jumble of stone blocks facing the street that paralleled the wall when larger raindrops splattered on their faces. A torrential downpour shut out all other sounds and limited visibility to 10 yards.
Thank you, God, if you're real.
I'll even go to Cathedral and pray along if you keep this rain going for another hour or so,
tittered Kales, raising his voice to be heard over the drumming of the rain.
For once I agree with you, said Balwis. No reason to try to act inconspicuous. Anyone not running in this rain will draw more attention than anyone creeping around. Let's run.
And ran they did. Up main streets, down alleys, and sometimes crossing streets they'd already traversed. Nothing looked consistent with Honorin's and Gwennon's descriptions. Despite Balwis's memory of Hounslow, and the information from Honorin and Gwennon, an hour passed, and their concern mounted that they might have to give up, because dawn was only a few hours away. They never considered leaving and re-entering the city. The fortuitous rain, and Wellman Stent's force moving into Eywell province in the morning, would make getting back into Hounslow nearly impossible. Guards would increase, or Erdalyn could be in the middle of Nathani forces as they reacted to the incursion, if he were still in the city at all. It had to be tonight.
I can see Edon to the south,
hissed Kales. Balwis turned his head. There it was. The moon Edon, visible on the horizon as a hazy globe. That meant the weather front that brought the rain would soon pass. Though Balwis couldn't tell for sure, he thought the downpour had slackened.
If we don't go soon, we ain't going anywhere, except into the ground, said Kales.
Just to the end of the street, said Balwis. This much is what Honorin said about alternating 2- and 3-story structures. If it's right, there should be a plaza around the corner and Erdalyn's villa on the other side. If it's not there, then we'll go. Shit.
They continued trotting down the street, staying clumped together, as would any group of men in the rain, not single file as assassins would act. They hoped. They turned the corner. There was enough light for them to tell that the side street opened to space. 30 more yards and they stood at the edge of a plaza. They couldn't clearly see the other side.
This has to be it.
Honorin just didn't remember the short street section between the plaza and the other street, said Balwis.
We'll work our way around to the right, said Kales. If this is it, there should be a cluster of trees along the side. We won't have time to study it if we're going in. Time is too short.
5 minutes later, Balwis climbed down from one of a dozen trees clustered along the outside of the villa's outer wall.
This is it. The front is exactly like Honorin described, right down to the ironwork horse rail and 2 big urns flanking the front door. But there's a complication. There should only be 1 guard at the door. Instead, there are 2. Both are right under a whale oil lantern and are doing their best to stay out of the rain. I didn't see either of them look around or at each other even once in the couple of minutes I watched. I don't think we can count on knowing how many guards there are anywhere.
Erdalyn's room should be the 3rd to 5th windows on the 2nd floor on this side, whispered Kales. We don't want him moving around the house, so we'll have to get him in the bedroom.
That means climbing and entering a window. Balwis couldn't see Kales's face, but he'd have bet everything he owned that the wiry man was grinning.
You can't go alone, said Balwis. After getting this far, we have to be sure.
What if Erdalyn is awake, or not in his room, or you get injured, or hell, anything can go wrong? The villa is made from stone blocks, and it looks like the mortar is recessed enough for grips and toeholds, so neither of us should need your climbing claws unless you need one for your hand.
I don't, whispered Kales.
The knife hilt can serve to jam into the crevices. I'll still be faster than you.
Balwis gathered the other 3 men.
Kales and I are going in after Erdalyn. If we can do it quietly, we'll come back out the window and over the wall to here. If it's noisy, the guards will come running. We know there are 3 in front of the house, 2 by the door and 1 at the villa wall's main gate. There's supposed to be 1 at the back and 1 inside, but who knows? If the guards are alerted, we don't have any choice but to kill them all before we leave. Otherwise,
word would get out too soon, and we'd never escape the city. We'll leave you our muskets and go in with only blades and pistols. Follow us over the wall. There's a bin 10 feet to the left. We can use it to get back over the wall. You'll have to judge whether the guards are alerted. In that case, don't worry about being quiet. Just kill them. Kales and I will come out the front door.
In the faint light from a few lit windows, Balwis could just make out 3 nods of understanding.
If any of you believe in God, this is a good time to call on him. Chaos, I'm after you.
With those words, Kales dropped his pack containing the climbing claws and clambered up the same tree Balwis had used. 4 men followed Kales. One by one, they jumped to the ground inside the villa grounds. Kales and Balwis handed off their muskets and, bending low, moved quickly to the villa wall. Kales ran his hand over the stone blocks and checked the gaps between blocks.
Plenty of room,
Kales whispered, and started up the wall. Balwis followed. Kales swarmed up the wall as if it were horizontal. But Balwis had broader fingers than Kales, and he had to jam his fingertips between some blocks to secure a hold. When Balwis had scaled halfway up the wall, Kales already stood in the balcony, peering into one window and then the next.
Can't see anyone inside,
whispered Kales when Balwis reached him.
There's a lantern burning low over a desk at the right of the room. I think I could see a door in the middle of the far wall. We'll have to go on cold and hope to find Erdlin asleep somewhere in the room. None of the windows open, so we'll go in through the balcony door.
They crouched in front of the door, and Kales used his good hand to apply firm, slow pressure to the door's latch. There was a faint creak, and Kales froze, listened for almost a minute, then pressed a bit more. The latch rotated a fraction, then freely for a quarter of a circle before stopping. He pulled, and the door gradually moved outward. When it was ajar a foot, Kale stopped and waited again, then opened it further, pulled a second knife, and slipped inside. The opening wasn't wide enough for Balwis, and he pulled gently. The gap had just widened enough for him when a hinge squeaked. There was a rustle inside the room. A flash illuminated enough for Balwis to see a tall man, naked and holding a pistol. Balwis ducked by reflex, but a zip and breaking glass before he'd reacted told Balwis the occupant had fired and missed. A woman screamed. A man cursed. Balwis flung open the door and rushed in. The low lantern gave enough light to reveal 2 men grappling, then leaping apart. The lantern light reflected off metal, as blades seemed to fly around the 2 men. A woman started to scream, then choked it off. Balwis assumed Kales to be the shorter of the men, but he couldn't be positive enough to use a pistol, and he feared drawing his own knife and joining in. The men moved too fast in the dim light. Balwis heard a musket fire outside, a second musket, yelling. A third shot. More yelling. He thought he recognized one of his men's voices. The shorter man never spoke a word, but the taller man cursed in Nathani. The tall man grunted and staggered back, catching his bare foot on the edge of a thick rug. Before he could recover, the other man was inside the Nathani's guard, his left arm jabbing outward. The tall man cried out in pain and shock, before the other man slashed across his throat with another blade. The Nathani fell to his knees.
Here's for Arnid, you fucker!
Kales yelled and stabbed Erdlin in the chest.
And Norlin, and Miramel, and guards whose names I don't know!
Erdlin was dead before the second stab. Footsteps pounded outside the bedroom door. Balwis stepped to the wall beside the door as it burst open. A man in an Athani uniform carrying a musket dashed into the room. Balwis shot him in the back, then looked into the hall. It was empty. More shots sounded, though from where he couldn't tell. He turned back into the room and went to the bedding in a corner of the room. A woman sat there, only a sheet covering her from the waist down. She wasn't screaming anymore, but her eyes flared wide as Balwis approached.
"Was that Erdalyn?" he demanded.
When she didn't answer immediately, he reached out, grabbed her by the hair, and turned her head toward the body.
"Is that Erdalyn?"
She choked and nodded.
"Yes, that's him, the bastard. May he rot in hell."
"Who are you?" asked Balwis.
"His slave. Who the hell do you think I am?"
she spit out, momentarily overcoming her fear. Kales walked up.
"We have to go now. There's fighting outside, and we don't know who's winning."
He looked at the woman.
"She's a witness."
"So?" said Balwis.
"She won't warn anyone faster than the firing has already done."
"Are you clansmen?"
she asked, throwing aside the covers and rising to her feet. Adrenaline flowing or not, and the need to move or not, Balwis couldn't help but admire her voluptuous, firm figure. She didn't wait for an answer.
"I'm from Pewit. The Nathani took me in a raid on my village 2 months ago. That pig on the floor claimed me. You have to take me with you."
"You'd only slow us down," said Kales.
"Just tell the Nathani it was clansmen. And we spared you only because you weren't Nathani."
"As if they'd give a shit. They'll probably torture me to see if I'm telling the truth. Then either kill me or send me to the brothels."
"I could just slit her throat. And then all our problems will be solved,"
Kales offered.
"She'll slow us too much."
The woman gasped and sat back on the bed. Balwis asked,
"And what would Tina think when she found out?"
Kales laughed.
"I just wanted to see what you'd say. I might actually start to like you, even if you don't have much of a sense of humor."
"We won't have much of anything if we don't get moving."
Balwis turned to the woman.
"You've got seconds to get dressed and follow us. We won't wait for you. If you can't keep up, you're on your own."
Kales peered into the hallway, then hurried toward the stairs he saw at the far end. Balwis followed. There were no more firings or shouts. When they reached the stairs, Balwis glanced behind. The woman held clothing and dressed as she caught up with them. She had paused only to spit on Erdalyn's body as she ran after them.
"Stay close,"
Kales told her, and they carefully started down the stairs.
"Kaelin,"
said a voice in the dark.
"Kernford,"
Kales called back.
"But you fixed him?"
asked Balwis.
"Yeah. Everything finished upstairs. Did you get him?"
"Yes.
Where are the others? And what about the other guards?"
"Sinton went running after the last guard, the one from the back. He took off over a fence. We shot the guards in front, but one of them got Ulrith. He's gone. Right through the gut. He wouldn't have lasted long. He said a prayer and asked me to finish him."
A door slammed open, and they heard running footsteps. All three crouched with blades. None had loaded firearms.
"It's me,"
a form called out.
"Couldn't catch the fucker."
Sinton walked into the lantern light and noticed the woman.
"Who's this?"
"She's coming with us," said Balwis.
"We have an extra horse now with Ulrith gone,"
Kale stated, as if casually noting the weather. "So we invited her along."
"Whatever," said Fixton. "I think we need to get the hell out of here."
The woman had finished dressing, and the five of them ran out of the villa, past the bodies of three guards and Ulrith, and through the main gate and into the plaza. Several windows of buildings surrounding the plaza showed light, from people awakened by gunfire. A man leaned out of one window, saw five persons,
four of them carrying muskets, and ducked back inside. The rain had slackened back to a drizzle, and Star started to join Eden, now fully shining. They ran across the plaza to the short piece of street and zigzagged through Hounslow Street toward the wall along the river. Three times they passed people without raising attention, until they were a few hundred yards from the wall. They turned a corner and almost ran into three Nathani soldiers carrying muskets over their shoulders. None of the three lived more than a few seconds, as Kales, Balwis, and Fixton each killed one before the Nathani could yell or brandish a weapon. Another 50 yards and bells began ringing, not the deep-toned abbey bells.
"It's the Nathani ringing out an alert," said the woman. "The man who got away must have reached the watch station. There are several stations around the city, and each one has several gongs. They sound like bells. Three strikes like they're doing means a threat inside the city. Continuous. Is the city in danger of being attacked?"
"Keep up or be left," Kales told her.
More lights came on as the alarm roused people, and they knocked several people down as they ran. When they reached the wall, a guard on the rampart called out for them to identify themselves. Fixed and shot at the man who disappeared, whether hid or hiding they didn't know, and had no further interest in finding out. They raced around the stone blocks and through the gap in the wall and found themselves on the outside and leaping down the slope. They were almost all the way down when the woman fell and tumbled past the men the last 50 yards. When they got to her, she was moaning and holding her ankle.
"I think it's broken," she sobbed. "Please don't leave me."
Kales revisited his repertoire of curses, but Balwis didn't hesitate. He picked up the woman and headed into the river. Low flow or not, he almost lost his footing three times before reaching the other bank. They ran for the thicket, with first Fixton and then Sinton taking turns carrying the woman. They reached the thicket where they'd left the horses 3 hours earlier, a span of time that seemed much longer. The woman couldn't control a horse with her ankle broken, so they put her in front of Fixton and led the empty horse by its reins. They had barely an hour before daylight. They could still hear the alarms from Hounslow, and 20 or more riders thundered across the grassy flat between the thicket and the river.
"I will ease," identified Kales, "sweeping the perimeter of the city. There'll be more any time now. We need to move."
First Light, Northern Rapid Reaction Force. Wellam and Stent watched as the first company started from its muster point a mile from the Iwell border. Its men were Stentees and would lead the force as it punched across the border and into any enemy patrols. Once clear of the border, that first company would fan out to serve as advance scouts to warn against more trouble than they could handle. The main order of advance and column consisted of three companies: the artillery unit with the 610 pounders delivered from Keelan, Stent's own foundry was not yet operational, and three more companies. Flanking the main column on both sides were two companies each. As they reached appropriate targets, companies would break off and rejoin the main column later. Wellman had commanded more men at Moreland City, but they had been his own clansmen, and their order had essentially been a single mass of riders, instead of the more complex organization of dragoon and artillery companies from different clans. Theory and training exercises would never prepare men for actual combat. Not that their purpose was to fight fixed battles. They planned to raise as much confusion and consternation as possible and force the Iwellese and Arthani's attention toward northern Iwell province and away from Dennis's southern force until it fulfilled its mission. They advanced at a walk until they reached the border, then moved into a trot. Distance was not a factor, so they could save their horses for when and if they needed to gallop. The artillery remained one limiting factor, because the horse teams plus cannon and limbers moved slower than the dragoons.
It would take less than an hour to reach the ruins of the Iwal town of Parthmal. Wellman Stent had led the attack on Parthmal after the Battle of Moreland City. They had surprised the Nathani camp, destroyed it, and gone on to burn the town. Stent didn't know how much of Parthmal's damage had been repaired, but now they would destroy whatever had been rebuilt. Once past Parthmal, Stent would order the flanking companies to spread out and burn any farm, ranch, or small settlement they came upon. If possible, they would circle Hounslow. However, the entire force would rejoin at the first sign of a significant enemy force and withdraw back to Moreland territory. Support Base, Iwal Province. Yosef followed Mulrun Lewis, supposedly to give advice, but Vortig Lewis's son was a quick study and also possessed an inherent sense of how to use space, a talent his father lacked. Except for contributing to selecting the site for the support encampment, Yosef had felt more like a tag-along than an advisor. He had alternated between riding his horse or sitting in a supply wagon beside the driver with Mr. Ed tied behind. Yosef's horsemanship had improved enough that by the time they arrived in Dornfeld, he wasn't sure whether a saddle or the wagon bench felt worse on his butt. Mulrun hadn't pushed the pace to save the horses, because the men had ridden their own mounts all the way to Dornfeld. There hadn't been any pre-positioned horses for the rapid reaction force. Once in Dornfeld, they spent the night, then pushed on across the Iwal border the next day. The one Iwal village they passed had been burned by Dennis's men, and they didn't stop. The villagers who didn't hide at Dennis's men's approach watched sullenly, while salvaging what they could. 20 miles past Dornfeld and 6 miles inside Iwal, they found what they were looking for. Just before the hills gave way to the coastal plain from Rexton to Palmth, they came upon a jumble of small buttes left by millennia of erosion. The slopes rose no more than 50 feet high, but steepness and disposition provided multiple defensible positions. Yosef and Mulrun agreed on a site where the road passed through a 400-yard gap flanked by two buttes. Scouts confirmed that for at least 5 miles in all directions, the gap was the only place horses could move. Mulrun ordered 600 men to dig positions for themselves and the cannon, and sent 200 men each to blocking positions north and south, should any Nathani or Iwalese force attempt to flank them. Mulrun also sent a platoon as a picket forward to within sight of the still-burning Rexton. Then, they waited.